Hello, and thank you for joining this Urology Times Medcast series exploring recent developments in the treatment of prostate cancer. This episode is entitled From Radiographic Progression-Free Survival to Quality of Life: What Really Matters When Applying Clinical Trial Data. I'm Jack Andrews. I'm a urologic oncologist and surgeon scientist at Mayo Clinic, Arizona in Phoenix.
Hi, I'm Alicia Morgans. I'm a GU medical oncologist, as well as being an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and the director of the Adult Survivorship Program at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston.
So we're excited to chat today. With more data than ever emerging in prostate cancer, clinicians are challenged to separate meaningful insights from the noise. And in this episode, we're going to break down why trial design actually matters and how endpoints like radiographic progression-free survival and quality of life should influence decision-making. We'll also explore how inclusion criteria, comparator arms, and then the real-world application shapes the relevance of new studies. So tune in for a practical look at translating evidence into patient-centered care. Joining us today, we're lucky to have Dr. Ashley Ross, who's a professor of urology and clinical director of the Polsky Urologic Oncology Center at Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago, Illinois, who's also a surgeon scientist. So thanks for joining us, Dr. Ross. Thank you all for listening in today, and let's begin.
Great. So let's start off, Ash, with some questions around, just data in prostate cancer. When you're thinking about the data that we're acquiring and whether it's through clinical trials, real world evidence, or something else, we're at a point where we really have just so many trials, so much data, so many things to consider. And as you think about that and sort through all the data, why does trial design come into your consideration? Does it really matter when you're thinking through everything that you're trying to sort through as you consider a patient in clinic and the treatment options that are available to him?
I think that it can be a little bit overwhelming. The trials are usually, a lot of them are geared towards approval of the drug more than like a pragmatic design in which choice you're going to make first, what sequencing of that choice. Often there's a trial design that I'll look at, and then also who got enrolled onto the trial is also very important. And does my patient look like those patients, or does the patient in front of me, like a minority subset, will this be applicable or not? As we go through the discussion here and we look at earlier endpoints, radiographic progression-free survival, melding that with some of the quality of life data we'll talk about today sometimes can give me a glimpse of like how this might play into their overall survival. And we'll get back to that point later. Trial design matters. It's hard to do trial-to-trial comparisons, but I often will think about other trials with other medications in similar category, as I look at the patient, and then obviously patient preference.
Yeah, really good points. And there's so many drugs out now, and all of these companies that have their own drug have multiple drugs in the wings, and it's going to get even more complicated, and it's going to be hard for us to maintain that same level of evidence required to change practice with clinical trials if we continue on this current pace of drug development. So I'm kind of interested in your thoughts. As more therapies are gaining approval in hormone-sensitive prostate cancer without direct comparisons, can we realistically continue to conduct these isolated trials? Or do we need to have a shift in the trial design, the strategy needed, the level of evidence needed to change practice? It's getting increasingly more complicated with sequencing. What's your thought on how we need to adjust there?
So if you want me to field it, or I can have Dr. Morgan's field it. But for myself, like I said, there's this dichotomy where there's trials being designed to get approval, and those are designed, specifically to meet some benchmark from the FDA. And I think maybe right, maybe wrong, the FDA has kind of moved the goalpost a little bit. Like earlier, Titan allowed us for progression-free survival, as an endpoint, and we even had those endpoints in some of the non-metastatic castration-resistant disease. Those things are, allowing for that endpoint, and then they're basically telling us as the providers to figure it out. The cooperative groups are where you can start to see more interesting designs because it's not the agenda is to figure out what works when and look at, subset questions, sometimes with comparators. I think about ARICOG, which is Dr. Morgan's trial, that's looking specifically at like enzalutamide, darolutamide, is there a cognitive difference, you know? And that's never going to be funded by a company, to be honest. Like, it's going to always have to come out of a cooperative group. And maybe some of the onus is back on us as providers. You know, in the meantime, you know, I would say that we can be a little bit more selective about things using, or more nimble using biomarkers and other things to kind of select what patient might be on what therapy. You know, I think about two different worlds. The world I do prefer is more options available and let me and the patient figure it out. That's probably the world I do prefer. And then us as clinician scientists designing thoughtful trials that are, you know, maybe, you know, practice informing. But you know, I'll get thoughts from others as well.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. And I like how you think about that. Really, trials that lead to approval of agents, which by their nature inherently need to be as simple as possible. They're really trying to compare two things. They're really trying to help sort of move the needle with a very specific goal and focus in mind. And there are specific goals and focus in mind for other trials that may be more around maybe label expansion or real pragmatic utilization. But they can be a little bit more creative in what the endpoints might be. For example, as you mentioned, a cognitive endpoint or an endpoint around function or frailty or those kinds of things, rather than cancer control as the primary endpoint, which is necessary when it comes to regulatory approval for a cancer drug. So that makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, as you also mentioned, and I think about it, when it comes to MCSPC, the days of using ADT alone as a control arm are probably over. This is just my opinion. Obviously, I'm not part of a regulatory body. And we did just see the ARANOTE trial, which I think is probably going to be the last one where ADT is going to be the real standard of care control arm. That being said, if you have a really frail population or a population that we know has an extreme response to ADT, maybe there is still a window for that to be a comparator arm in a de-escalation type of a trial. Again, to sort of take a population more at risk, maybe more responsive, and try to spare them intensified treatment. So maybe that's what we'll see next. But when it comes to the general population, I think we're probably moving in the direction of having control arms that have evolved into these you know, combination type trials. And, you know, the other thing that I think about when we consider trials is the inclusion criteria. You know, these very, very clearly affect how we interpret the data, to your point, Ash, and also they affect whether we can really consider them in the context of the patient sitting in front of us in clinic, who may or may not look like this patient who's fit enough, has well-controlled comorbid illness, you know, is able to come to follow-ups on a very regular basis, complete the testing and the pieces of the trial that are necessary for them to continue enrollment. How do those things impact the way that you interpret clinical trial data, Ash? Like, what do you think about the generalizability of studies to the population that you see in clinic?
Yeah, you know, I'll just touch on one thing and I'll go into that. One thing I was saying is I would like the freedom for all these agents. And then, like we figured out later, one thing that always hamstrings us, though, is when the payers then have to pay for the agent, they want to like make it look exactly like it was in the trial, which is always hard. But going back to your question is like, you know, the nice thing is the inclusions have been relatively broad, and that lets people come on to trials. But like you said, we don't have a lot of very elderly population and, you know, on these studies. And there are a lot of people who are elderly who are, you know, seeing us, you know, octogenarians and beyond, where there's considerations of how much therapy might be too much therapy. There's not, you know, there's not a lot of like, there's a lot of good compliance kind of like sort of baked into these trials that may not be the case. And so we wonder if someone's off therapy. And a lot of the trials, I think the new generation is, just like you said, will need more active comparator arms. I think when I think about trials going, more active comparator arms, we need to have companion biomarkers in every trial. Because like that, and we have to become more willing to accept subset analyses, you know. The nice thing, and you mentioned in the beginning, there's so much data out there now, it can be overwhelming. The nice thing is it allows you to pick and choose your data. So we see like People with like who have a really low PSA nadir having great progression-free survival. Maybe my very elderly gentleman who we're worried about any type of frailty, we start him on ADT, his low volume metastatic disease, his PSA responds super robustly, and we leave him on that. Or more so, as you do these other analyses you presented recently, we'll talk about it later, the ARANOTE quality of life data, where the quality of life actually goes up on drug, which, kind of essentially stating that it controls the disease and has very low, kind of morbidity to it, that might be a go-to there. So I think we can actually put patients mostly in the buckets, and we can be a little bit flexible with what we do around, the trials. One thing we might come back to later, and we think about trial design as well, and do we accept progression-free survival as an endpoint? I think we have to be thoughtful about it. Nowadays, we're dealing with active therapies, and we're comparing active therapies to active therapies. We're not like really figuring it out. We're figuring out what's best and what's more active. And so you want to allow for crossover, when people at RPFS, if it shows really good activity, you want to allow for crossover, which kind of ruins your OS, And I think we have to think about that a little bit too. And are we going to accept, what their PFS is? And then again, have to really layer on the quality of life data. So it's not a great answer, but I'll say there's enough trials out there and enough data that I can fit it into the patient in front of me. And we have enough biomarkers in prostate cancer land for both initial decisions and for follow-up that we can usually make sequential guesses in all but the worst cases.
Yeah, I really agree with that. I think you both had great points. One of the things you said, Alicia, ARANOTE's probably the last trial that we're going to be able to use ADT monotherapy as a comparator. And I think as we get more and more drugs, it's going to get infinitely more complicated of what is the appropriate comparator. It makes me wonder if, maybe we need to start having access to patient-level data from trials so that we can do, you kind of bridge the gap between real-world evidence and a pure randomized controlled trial to really kind of inform ourselves a little bit more about what's happening on a trial-to-trial comparison. And the other point you made was about the impact of generalizability. It's always befuddled me why we kind of lump de novo and metachronous together in all these trials when we know they have different outcomes and different prognoses. And so I think we need to really look at those subset analyses, like you said, Dr. Ross, and figure out how that trial and that drug is going to affect the patient that's sitting in front of you. And the question I would ask you is, when you get a new trial result, what's the first thing you're going to do when you look at that trial behind, besides just what's the headline? What's the sexy headline, but what are you going to dig into for that trial?
Again, I actually first look at the demographics table, to be quite frank, and see what is like who went on the study. Then, as if I look at if I look at the different survival curves that are there, I look for what's like the absolute benefit, whether it be measured by time or whatnot. Thankfully, we've seen more trials paired to their quality of life data, and you get a sense there too. But I think that those are the major things I look at. And then, the other thing I think about is access. Is this repurposing of a drug that's already out there, and then I have an easier access? Is it going to be, is it much more difficult to get to? I agree with your point that like the devil's in the details, and usually after going through the article once quickly, I find myself deep into the supplemental materials looking at, well, who actually was on it. But yeah, I'll have Dr. Morgans chime in as well.
Yeah, I think that's the surgeon scientist in you, Ash. And I think that, the other thing I'm sure that you dig into is the molecular data if it's available on the subsequent analyses. But, those are the things that I look at too. And I try to understand what are the other outcomes that are relevant beyond survival? What's the quality of life? What is the symptomatic skeletal event rate, and is there a difference between the two treatment arms? So there are other things, I think, and then the adverse events, you know, very much of high importance there. But I would agree. You know, one thing that gets tricky with these things, though, is when you start to make all these comparisons, you know, some of them are absolutely built into the statistical plan, so they're included, and there could be maybe a hierarchical, you know, stats plan or whatever it is, but they're considered and they're a priori sort of drawn out in terms of what makes this result statistically significant, so that we have that information. But especially if we get into different subgroups, maybe some that weren't necessarily incorporated in the stats plan, or we are looking into something that we want to explore after we see the data and we want to compare that, but it wasn't planned before. I think there can be this consideration around, you know, these numbers look different. They seem clinically relevant to me. It may or may not reach statistical significance. And then how do we interpret that? So I wonder, you know, what do you think about that, Ash, and all the comparisons that we make? What do you think about that?
Well, I'll tell you, there's a tendency for me to like sometimes point fixate and like it look at a subset, see robusting and really believe it, but it's not actually powered. There's not the evidence there. You know, and I wonder, like, if we're talking about, say, hormone-sensitive metastatic prostate cancer, you know, after, like, some of the triplet therapy trials came out, ADT plus, you know, darolutamide plus docetaxel, piece one, which was then abiraterone ADT and docetaxel, you know, I part of me is like looking for, well, can I use all the data out there? And there's like now some data that comes out of like Stampede analysis that uses biomarkers that's been presented that's completely retrospective, looking at, you know, very high Decipher P10 loss and saying, okay, these guys might be more, you know, chemo responsive. You know, part of me wants to like use that data to say, okay, what am I going to start with? Use a PSA nadir, then decide about docetaxel. And I might be guiding patients in the wrong way. I might be under treating patients because I'm making a false assumption, you know, and I do worry about that a lot. And particularly when we look at pure, you know, biomarker retrospective analysis, you know, luckily where I am, one of your old partners, Dr. Hussein, is sort of on the other end, really needs firm evidence. And, you know, quite frankly, as a urologist, mostly a surgeon, you know, like you said, I'm a surgeon scientist, but also headstrong as a surgeon. And I've learned to listen a little bit better and to my med oncs and like think a little bit more about big picture and, you know, what's the trade-off. So I would say caution with the subgroup analysis has been my new thing. And whereas before it was a lot of excitement. And then at each step, think about in the next 3 months where you go on a certain therapeutic strategy, you know, what does a patient lose if you're wrong? You know, what do they gain? You know, and, you know, luckily we're not always playing with fire in prostate cancer, and we do have a little bit of flexibility.
So I really like what you said, especially as surgeons kind of looking at data sometimes a little bit differently. I mean, sometimes in the operating room, the level of evidence that, you know, taught us why we do what we do is not the level of evidence that we need for a change in practice for systemic therapy. And sometimes you look at these Kaplan-Meier curves and there looks to be a difference, but it's not statistically significant. And it makes you wonder, you know, why is there not a statistical benefit here? And I think that's a challenge that we'll deal with. You also brought up something earlier about radiographic progression-free survival. What are your thoughts of that as a primary endpoint versus overall survival? You talked about crossover trials, you know, radiographic progression-free survival logically makes sense. If you're not seeing the disease for a longer period of time, the patient's doing better, but it doesn't always translate into overall survival. So how do you think about that conundrum?
I think that there's three parts of it that I think about. One is, in the old days where there was less crossover, you know, it had a little bit more meaning because you could also follow to get the OS outcome later. And so the issue is if you get to radiographic progression-free survival and it's better on your therapy, but your therapy has ruined subsequent therapies for the patient, then, you know, you may not get that overall survival benefit. And, you know, that is tricky. And so one way you can use as a surrogate is I can look at the RPFS with AEs, you know, together and kind of, and also if I can get some quality of life data to get an idea of patient robustness as they come out of therapy. And if I see that AEs are very tolerable, you know, quality of life data looks at least the same, but even, you know, like I mentioned before for Aranote, maybe even better, you know, that gives, that has a lot of, you know, power in it. You know, it's hard to design the trials ethically without allowing crossover for active therapy. You know, it's like it's, and then there's such a moving target. So I would not want to see RPFS go away as an important endpoint. I also think that if RPFS is met and it was decided with a regulatory body that that is going to allow for approval, then it should allow for approval so that everyone can feel better about rapid crossover for patients on trial. I'd like to get thoughts of the group, but I think that if you're going to use RPFS, which I like, you got to combine it with how morbid was the therapy to kind of get in your mind an idea of how what the setup is for future therapeutic options.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's such a challenge if there's a conversation with a regulatory agency and everyone decides, hey, we've got this primary endpoint, we've got this stats plan, and we're going to aim for that difference between groups, and that's met if then the goalposts shift, because these trials take so long and they're extremely expensive. And perhaps most importantly, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of patients who put their blood, sweat, and tears literally into that study, and to have it not be of value or sufficient value is just disheartening. So I think as a field, we are generally accepting RPFS, and we have to, because some of these trials are looking at high-risk localized disease even, and biochemical recurrent disease, and certainly metastatic hormone-sensitive disease. And the time to survival is going to be years, we hope. So we need to have something that's intermediate. And particularly when we think about radiographic progression-free survival, when we define it by CTs, bone scans, these conventional imaging modalities, I think it's pretty robust. And we have this metastasis-free survival kind of idea in mind, at least when it comes to a biochemical recurrence, and then this new metastases and radiographic progression-free survival, I think still is pretty well accepted when it comes to metastatic disease. Where it gets complicated, Ash, and you need to solve this problem for all of us, yeah, in the field. What do you do when you have PSMA PETs integrated, and you can stipulate whatever you want on the trial, and we do, obviously, but we don't always have... we don't limit people's ability to get whatever imaging modality they want in their routine clinical practice. And PSMA PET, it's definitely here, and it definitely influences things. So what do you think about that in terms of radiographic progression-free survival and where we're going?
Yeah, I would say a couple things. Like, you know, when we looked at our Northwestern data, initial staging with PSMA PET is over 90% of our initial staging. The minority get any conventional imaging. Obviously, in the BCR setting, it's basically 100% PSMA PET. And I'll say this, I'll back up for a second. When I look at a patient and I'm originally classifying them in my mind, it's not necessarily who's going to be treating them as med onc, but I don't really ascribe as much to this high-low volume as like with by conventional imaging. You know, Dr. Andrews kind of pointed out a little bit earlier, like I look at like, is he synchronous, metachronous? What is the metastatic burden, even by PET imaging, forget conventional. And I start to think a little bit about, you know, genetics and genomics. And I know, even though, like I said, we have to be cautious, a lot of interesting data coming out of like genomic stuff from like, again, from the Stampede group, retrospective with Decipher, a lot of data that we can look at from, you know, smaller signatures, like, you know, if the guy has an RB loss, PT3 loss, and you know, something like this, even on NGS that they're getting. How does this define how active their disease is and how many locations is their disease at? And it doesn't, again, this is a point where I might point fixate and I might guess wrong, you know, someone with like where conventional imaging shows a couple bone lesions and they're just riddled with bone mets on PET PSMA, I really feel that that's high volume. This is just a better detection agent. I think that PET, you know, radiographic progression-free survival can be defined by PET PSMA imaging. I think the ARIS-STEP trial is the first one that's really looking at that. That's like, you know, darolutamide and ADT in the BCR setting. That's going to be the first one that's using it in part of their endpoint. But clinically, I use that all the time, and it's extremely rare where, you know, we're confident that there's progression on the PET PSMA and that guy is not progressing, you know. Now, what's not extremely rare is a false positive on a PET PSMA scan that can take us in the wrong direction. So it's, you know, so it's kind of all there, but I'm completely bought into the PET PSMA. I think we have to use more genetics and genomics, and that combination of for risk stratification and whether and what they've got, how what their natural history has been, synchronous or metachronous, is really where we should be like thinking about classifying patients.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what you've said, and it really is something that I struggle with. Again, that we, at least at Mayo Clinic, our med oncs are almost exclusively using PSMA PET as our surveillance imaging modality. But these trials have been so resistant, and whether it's from the regulatory bodies or whatever reasons, that we still need to use conventional imaging. And it's just not what we're doing in clinical practice. And just to kind of move us to the localized staging setting, just I think there are similar conundrums that we can try to draw comparisons. You know, if we get a PSMA PET and we see a node that's positive on PET that we didn't see on MRI, it's a huge question for us. You know, is this a real node that we should treat just like we saw it on conventional imaging? And other than the exceptions, probably not offer surgery, depending on what kind of camp you sit in. Or are we looking at a node that's in an earlier biologic state that they're likely to benefit? And so it's really something that I struggle with is, you know, where does PSMA PET fall in terms of, you know, relevance compared to conventional imaging, and how do we start implementing what we're actually doing in clinical practice in trials? But I wanted to shift focus here a little bit. You mentioned the importance of quality of life data, and our own Dr. Morgans here recently presented at ASCO 2025 on some of the quality of life data from the ARANOTE trial. And what were your thoughts on some of the top line data that she reported, and kind of what specific quality of life data stands out to you when you look at a trial like this?
For me personally, and then I'll have Dr. Morgan's comment, but it was the first time that I saw the more active therapeutic arm do better than the, you know, comparator arm. And that was excellent to see. It meant to me, this is again darolutamide plus ADT versus ADT comparator in people with metastatic hormone-sensitive disease. It meant to me that, like, in the past, you know, they wouldn't do it at a patient level, but essentially, you know, the presumption was the reason that the curves, like for FACT-P, which is one of these quality of life things, overlapped was that the patients getting the active, more active treatment had some toxicity, but they were like, you know, not progressing as much. And so you had this kind of balance, and now the line looks the same as people who are having some progressions and more toxicity, et cetera. This time, the patients are doing better, which means they're not as getting a lot of toxicity, most likely, and they have an active therapy. And so I can't remember, I'll ask Dr. Morgans, I can't remember another pair of curves, at least in prostate cancer, where the more active, like more efficacious oncological arm had a better quality of life, you know, not the same, but better. You know, it was a great study. Maybe you can talk to it a little bit.
Sure. So I think certainly chemo doesn't look like that. And there's no other androgen receptor inhibitor that looks like that. Abiraterone, interestingly, did seem to help improve quality of life a little bit, but that's not an AR inhibitor. It's different. It does require prednisone. And, you know, there are other toxicities, mineralocorticoid excess, LFT abnormalities that we have to watch for. And also these questions raised in the stopcap analysis and actually another analysis done around the same time that suggests that particularly for older adults, this can be a challenging agent despite what was seen in the Latitude trial. So I think it is unique, and it's also unique when it's not just the patients that report that they feel better, but the CTCAE, the assessment of these adverse events, is also better with the drug than with the placebo. I've never seen that.
Yeah,
That I
and
think is interesting.
there may be some more to dig in there, but for me, what it did is, and kind of Dr. Morgan's mentioned this earlier, and I think you too, Dr. Andrews, is, you know, she was saying that, like, you know, we can no longer have ADT alone as a comparator arm. And then there are some people out there who said, like, well, when we're talking about subsets, maybe my older patient, my more frail patient, they weren't on this trial, they weren't on that trial. But now, you know, you've got, you know, this data with, you know, darolutamide that like you see low drug-drug interactions, low AEs, you know, improved quality of life, you would be very hard pressed, or I'd be very hard pressed to not start we call it a doublet, like ADT plus daro in a patient, you know, almost regardless of frailty, almost, I say, because like again, there's maybe some few exceptions, and feel more confident. I mean, that's what it boosted, you know, for me is the confidence in saying like, there's no reason I shouldn't start a doublet. Like maybe you can, you know, like make arguments about other AR inhibitors that might be more associated with falls or fractures or things like this. But now you really, you know, see that in the frail patient as a clear choice. That it really emboldened that in my own thinking.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And the quality of life data that we saw from ARANOTE really, I think, is helpful for us to figure out, particularly for those comorbid patients and more frail patients. And I think you're spot on with why wouldn't we put them on a doublet with Daro with a favorable AE profile when we have that option now and we have good data there. Kind of switching gears a little bit back to trials. There are some landmark trials, STAMPEDE and LATITUDE, that were the same drug but had different trial designs. And so how do you interpret those trial designs, or how does that different trial design influence your practice when you look at those trials, same drug, but how they evaluated the drug was a little bit different?
You know, the question, it becomes a little bit moot because STAMPEDE did so much with their drug. You know, like in other words, you know, because STAMPEDE had this inclusion of all these folks, non-metastatic, very high risk, N1, M0 patients also, and then all these metastatic folks, you know, including high volume, low volume, you know, what LATITUDE did didn't matter as much anymore, you know, because so in other words, like I think that, you know, the folks, I'm sure they're, you know, they should be very proud of themselves. The folks in the UK that put together STAMPEDE and this sort of like, you know, adaptive design with different control arms and everything's moving. It's been excellent. And this, it showed us that like, we want to bring this data, these drugs earlier. So for like Abby, you know, node positive, you know, even post-prostatectomy node positive, sometimes in the salvage setting, we're doing it, it'd be ahead of some of the data, we're doing doublet. And the question that's now in my mind is not, does more intense androgen blocking or androgen axis blocking therapy benefit overall outcomes? But the other question in my mind is like, well, you know, are these drugs really the same? Can I superimpose my darolutamide and tell the person that like, oh, quality of life was excellent and this is going to be superimposable? Or do I have the patience to wait for all the trials that are well designed that are kind of accruing and going on? And I think I have, you know, well, be forced to wait because of the, you know, because of getting the drug can still be problematic. But like I said, if you have a trial design, like it's a great, comes to a head what we should be doing. If you have a trial design like STAMPEDE that covers almost all the bases, you know, LATITUDE is trying to like, let's get this out there. And it's that difference in that trial design. We really want to look more like STAMPEDE than LATITUDE, but the people that participated and made LATITUDE happen, that was fantastic. It really brought things to our patients earlier. Both were around 2017, but still, you know.
I never really thought of it that way, but I agree with you. It's really interesting the way that STAMPEDE certainly has cornered the market on most spaces included in a single clinical trial. And LATITUDE, really just focusing on the high-risk patients, de novo metastatic. I think they gave us sort of a more precise lens in that population, but STAMPEDE absolutely led to an approval that has changed the landscape. And it's very helpful. You know, just as the studies with triplet therapies are also really helpful. We've got PEACE-1, we've got ARASENS, slightly different, certainly different in the way that docetaxel was included, and different a little bit in terms of, you know, de novo population versus an all-comers population in ARASENS. So I wonder, how do you think about these two trials? How do you use the data? Does it affect the way you choose treatments when you're in those conversations with your medical oncologists for patients that you've now shown, oh, wow, these patients actually have metastatic disease. I can't take them to the OR, or I don't want to take them to the OR. How does that come into play in your thought process?
There's two major things that come into play for me. One is whatever's going on in my mind, my gut is leaning more towards the AeriSense data because I can't remember. I often am telling patients and talking to medical oncologists about starting darolutamide, docetaxel, you know, ADT. And rarely are we, advocating for abiraterone. Now, whether that's good or bad or, you know, based on the data, you know, like you said, it's more all comers for AeriSense, et cetera. The major thing with has to do with trial design is, you know, people try to put the docetaxel into this bucket, like for high volume patients, we should be doing it. You know, I think that one thing that's going to trickle through this conversation is there are chemo fit, non quote unquote high volume charted criteria patients that likely will benefit from docetaxel, you know, and we're getting more research there. There were some, I can't remember which trial it was, but maybe it was piece one. It looked at people from the latitude criteria versus charted criteria and like was showing again, like, you know, oncological benefit for high risk metastatic. So my major thing that I'm now with for chemo myself is, you know, I don't think that I has been as chemo forward as I should have been in talking to the patients. You know, docetaxel obviously does have some morbidity, you know, particularly younger patients, maybe a little bit neuropathy. You know, yes, there can be some cytopenias, but generally well tolerated. And I think that we should be using this. Certainly, I think we should be using it more. And for us as urologists, be like kind of more telling the patients that we should be using it more. The way AeriSense was designed, it does allow for like a spot check on how well they're, responding to the ADT. Like I mentioned before, there might be some newer genetic or genomic biomarkers that can maybe give you a window into that. But if anything, I take the trials together and I think, geez, I should be using this more, not just high volume even, maybe select low volume patients, you know, can get through it. I'd like to get other thoughts, but that's kind of where I'm at.
We're coming up on time. I want to say thank you so much, Dr. Ross. I think this was a really fruitful conversation. You went through a lot on trial design, quality of life data, really informative. I also want to thank Dr. Morgans for co-hosting this with me, and thank you for everybody who listened to this. I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Great conversation.
Thanks, Dr. Ross. That was awesome.
Hey, I'm so sorry I was caught up in the OR. And like, you know, I know you guys are on, you may not be, but Alicia, I know, is on Eastern time and like, you know, the rest of the crew might be. So I really appreciate the thoughts, you know, hopefully the audience gets a few things through it. Nobody should be on single ADT almost anymore. And everybody should at least get with metastatic disease, at least needs like, you know, NGS testing to see if they're what they're going to be on, but I really appreciated it. Alicia, congratulations on the Aeronote data. It is, you know, it did help me a lot. You know, every once in a while, you still have an inhibition. You know, you've seen on the Aerosec where I've had a lot of people on trials, I never really saw many side effects, but I've had people on Enza, APA, more frail, have serious, serious problems. And, you know, and you remember that. And I worry sometimes about suggesting doublet in some of my patients. And after your data was presented, I just felt like it did exactly what I said. It just gave my comfort level and it really even nails in further, you know, how could you possibly put someone on ADT alone if their quality of life is going to be better? You know, the biggest issue is access, you know, like that's now the issue, but thanks for thinking about me. And I'm sure I'll see you at some meetings. You know, Jack, I don't think we've met in person before, but I'm sure now that we've seen each other once, I think I'll see you all the time.
Yes. Well, every meeting we'll run into each other. Well, yes. SUO is in Phoenix in my hometown this year. So I'll see you here, hopefully.
Perfect.
That's good. Thank you, Ash. Good to see you. Great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jenny. Thank you. Have a good night, everybody.
Thanks again, everyone. Thank you. Thanks, Alicia. Nice to see you.
Thanks. Good to see you. Bye-bye.
Thank y'all.